On this week's 51%, we take a feminist self-defense course with safety instructor and author Meg Stone and learn how most safety advice is sexist rather than effective.
Even when it is given with the most sincere intentions, what it ultimately becomes is a form of coercive control, a way of mostly men telling mostly women what to do.
I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh Lita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. Most of us are familiar with the anxiety that can come from walking alone at night or weighing what kind of self-defense keychain to add to your purse. There's a lot of safety advice out there for women that focuses essentially on stranger danger. And yes, strangers can pose a threat to anyone, especially women, but our guest today argues that a lot of the safety advice given to women is sexist, as well-meaning as it may be. And it doesn't accurately address the kinds of dangerous situations women are most likely to face or help fight inequality and gender-based violence on a broader scale. Meg Stone is the executive director of Impact Boston, a nonprofit working to combat domestic violence and other forms of abuse, in large part by teaching self-defense. Stone has been with Impact as a safety instructor for roughly 20 years, and she's got a new book compiling what she's learned called The Cost of Fear: Why Most Safety Advice is Sexist and How We Can Stop Gender-Based Violence. Stone teaches a specific method of self-defense she calls empowerment self-defense, feminist self-defense, or, quote, safety through resistance. While geared toward women, she says anyone can benefit from it, and given the politically divisive and fraught time we're in, activists can stand to learn from it, too. Just a heads up for our listeners, this conversation does touch on domestic violence and sexual assault. Not graphically, but still, if those subjects are triggering to you, this might not be the episode for you. If you or someone you love has been impacted, please know help is available. The National Domestic Violence Hotline is open 24/7 at 1-800-799-SAFE or by texting START to 88788. RAIN's National Sexual Assault Hotline can be reached at 1-800-656-HOPE.
It is very important to be able to depend on legal, educational, all of the systems that we depend on for so many things for our safety. It is the responsibility of the leaders of those institutions to ensure safety. But nobody who is paying any attention believes that that really happens. So for me, it was so important to have a way of preventing harm, a way of maintaining safety that could live inside the people that are most targeted for sexual assault, domestic violence, harassment, and all other types of gender-based violence. And I was lucky enough to discover feminist self-defense in my early 20s. And after finding the power of my body, and learning that I could access power even when I was scared. For me, that was such a shift in my mindset and a shift in the way I lived my life. I was bolder, I was braver, and as much as it's important to me that that helped me in my personal life, it was more important to me that it made me more equipped to handle harassment or detractors or push back when I was working for social and political change. Some of the folks that I interviewed for this book really had an experience of empowerment and healing for themselves. And it was equally important for me to interview folks that were using self-defense training as a tool for social justice organizing. And that practice dates back to the 1920s, to the women's suffrage movement. And it was also very prevalent in the Black liberation movement in the 50s and 60s and 70s. And more recently, some of the folks that I've interviewed for my book are organizing janitorial workers for safe and equitable working conditions, and teach self-defense as part of Know Your Rights.
In your book, you contend that most safety advice being offered to women is sexist. Why do you think that?
One of the reasons why it was so important to me to write this book is because I very clearly see a difference between individual self-defense or safety skill building that furthers or supports social change, as well as approaches to self-defense or personal safety that work against social change. A lot of the safety advice that women get is all about what we shouldn't do and how we should make our lives smaller. Almost every woman I know, and frankly, the teenagers I taught 20 years ago and the teenagers I taught last month were giving me the same feedback about what they'd been told. Everything from don't walk alone at night, don't wear your hair in a ponytail, an attacker could grab it, don't park near a white van. I don't know about you, but I live in a place where it's really hard to park. So if you find a parking spot, no matter what, I don't care if there's gigantic trucks around it. If it's a legal spot, I'm taking it. But the focus of that safety advice is on expecting women to follow rigid rules that make our lives smaller. And even when it is given with the most sincere intentions, the most heartfelt, some of the people who give these rigid safety directives are very caring and very compassionate people who truly want to help. But what it ultimately becomes is a form of coercive control, a way of mostly men telling mostly women what to do. And there's two big problems with what I call safety through compliance, safety advice that alleges that we will avoid violence if we follow rules. First of all, it's completely irrelevant to most of the violence that women, that non-binary folks, that LGBTQ folks face, in that it is all about strangers. It is very, hard to make the leap between not parking near a white van and the epidemic of sexual assault from people we know. It's not relevant, it's not useful. But when you look at the actual, like I could have a belief system and I could be passionate about it, and that would be fine. But when you look at the research evidence, self-defense programs that are explicitly feminist, that make very clear connections between gender inequity and political realities and how that relates to the date you just went on last Friday night, actually reduce sexual assault by 50% or more. And the more sort of rule-based or compliance-based safety advice, there is no published research showing that following any of those rules reduces any type of violence. So my hope for this book was for people to see that there is a difference between what I call safety through compliance and what I call safety through resistance, which is really about challenging authority, speaking up, advocating for ourselves, making choices about the mundane things like who gives us hugs and who doesn't, or the bigger things like who we have sex with, who we don't have sex with, and how safety through resistance can both give us better, safer, saner personal lives and contribute to emboldening us to work for social change. And also, the final chapter looks at how the organizations and communities that welcome and embrace people to speak up, to advocate for themselves, to say no, to constructively resist, are the ones that are most effective at stopping sexual abuse. Anybody can write a zero tolerance statement. Anybody can hang it up in a bathroom, or anybody can make everybody click through HR slides. But when it comes to actually creating an environment where people have many experiences of their bodily autonomy and their boundaries being welcomed and respected, that is an incredibly powerful change strategy.
Well, let's dive a little bit more into safety through resistance, as you call it then. What does practicing it look like? And, you know, I liked that phrase you used earlier about knowing you can protect yourself even when you're scared. So how is impact doing that?
The underlying value system is this: you are not the problem. You are not in this class because you did something wrong and you were assaulted. You are here because we live in a world where people choose to harm other people, and the institutions and individuals that are around us cannot always stop them. So, because we don't want you to live in fear, we are going to help you develop some skills that will enable you to resist someone else's attempt to try and harm, harass, intimidate, or assault you. So that's sort of the 30,000 foot aspect of what we do. The practical, experiential aspect of what we do is we present people with a range of physical and verbal skills that they can use to interrupt an act of violence against them or someone else. Sometimes folks interrupt it very early. Other times, some of our students have been in a sexual encounter at college. Somebody took it further than they wanted to. They said no, and in the middle of that sexual encounter, they used a physical skill and got out of that dorm room. So every physical skill that we teach is designed to be accessible to a lot of people's bodies. I don't want you to be an ultimate fighting champion. I was a last kid picked in gym class my entire childhood. Every physical skill that's taught is a skill that doesn't require a lot of coordination or athletic ability, and that is designed to level the playing field. If somebody is 6'8" and 400 pounds and solid muscle, I need to take a strong part of my body and use it against a weak part of their body. The verbal skills are used to stop an attempted assault or harassing or threatening situation before we need to use physical skills. So the verbal skills are designed to give people the experience of advocating for themselves and finding their power. We teach some pretty straightforward phrases like stop and leave me alone. And if somebody is baiting me, harassing me, particularly with some of our collaborators that are doing, testifying at school board meetings and people are shouting transphobic things at them in the parking lot, keeping it very simple, stop, leave me alone, getting into an insult war with somebody is really not going to get us very far. Another aspect of empowerment self-defense is that it challenges stigma and it challenges the mythologies that equate violence with people who are otherwise devalued. So it's not the intoxicated person on the street. It's not the person who lives outside. It's not the person who's poor who is a threat to me. What is the behavior that shows that someone is a threat to me? You know, there's a million nuances and a million shades, but quite simply, if I say what I want and what I need and what's okay for me and what's not okay for me, and the person acts like that didn't happen, that's the red flag. It's pretty obvious how equating danger with stigma is a problem for people who are experiencing that stigma. But it's also a problem for more privileged people because if I have my gut level fear response when I see a drunk person sitting on the sidewalk, then my intuition is miscalibrated. And so when my coworker starts giving me a back massage, and then when I don't like it and tell him that, he tells me to lighten up and, all of those other things. Then I'm still thinking about that guy outside my office who has a lot of problems, but is not a threat to me. Another really defining characteristic of empowerment self-defense is that we teach resistance skills that could be used on someone we know. Sometimes it's a dating partner or acquaintance trying to sexually assault us. The research on sexual assault is more robust than the research on intimate partner violence, and there's a lot of complexity in terms of using physical self-defense with a current intimate partner. So I don't want your listeners to take away that that's simple and straightforward because it's really not. But we have had a lot of folks who developed the courage to leave an abusive partner after learning that they could resist and they could protect themselves. You know, some of what we do in our team classes is ask hard questions about what would it mean to have to use these skills against someone you know or like or love, and what would get in your way? And then, more importantly, how can you work with what would get in your way? So it's not just about, you know, learning a fancy kick or punch, but it's about saying, like, if somebody that I'm dating does not stop a sexual encounter when I say no, it is okay for me to speak up. And I trust that the people in my life, or at least enough of the people in my life, will support me. And I trust my own body and my own voice. We actually have instructors who portray aggressors. So we actually practice responding to threats, intimidation, harassment, coercion in the moment with a person. And these instructors are wearing specialized physical protective gear so that not only do we practice speaking up, but we can practice using our whole bodies and hitting as hard as we can so that we have that lived, embodied experience of resistance. But the key is, as a teacher, it is not my job to tell you what to do. Because, first of all, I don't know you. I don't know your life. I don't know what's right for you. But also, following what an authority figure says does not make us safer. Deciding for ourselves what works for us makes us safer. One of my favorite things as a teacher is when I present a self-defense strategy or a technique or an idea, something that I believe in, and someone in my class is like, no, I wouldn't do it that way. That wouldn't work in my community, or that wouldn't work in my relationship, or that wouldn't work in my life. What about this? And I always, like, even if like my ego is bruised because I love my technique, I always have to remember that that is the skill that equips people to stop violence. Because gender-based violence is enacted in the most intimate spheres of our lives. And being removed from public view is a defining characteristic of most types of gender-based violence. So, for example, some of the most vocal supporters of the Me Too movement were found to have been abusing their intimate partners. Owen LaBrie, who was the private school student in New Hampshire that was sexually harming a younger student as part of the private school's senior salute program, wrote an op-ed for the school paper saying that senior salute is a bad idea. And then outside of public view, he participated in it. So that sign that you saw on the subway is really not suited to this particular problem.
We're speaking with Meg Stone, author of The Cost of Fear: Why Most Safety Advice is Sexist and How We Can Stop Gender-Based Violence. Something you said a few minutes ago actually just stuck with me. You know, that sometimes in your classes, someone will tell you, I wouldn't approach a situation this way. That wouldn't work for me or my community. I guess, what are some of the different ways you notice safety tactics differing across ideologies, communities, and demographics?
That's a really good question. People who teach personal safety skills range widely, but a lot of the more politically conservative approaches to self-defense are really rooted in personal responsibility and are really sort of the violence or harm is often framed as if it is a natural disaster, as if it is rain, as if it is hurricanes, as if it is a tornado. And what we as individuals can do is take responsibility for ourselves and protect ourselves. You know, I think there are really smart and decent people who have that belief system. The concern that I have is some of the safety advice that groups like the National Rifle Association put out are often very restrictive and not fact-based. One of the directives is that you should do your laundry with a friend or neighbor and don't do your laundry early in the morning or late at night. They also say if you're a woman alone in the house or apartment and a stranger asks to speak to your husband or the man of the house, tell them he's working in the garage or office and cannot be disturbed. Never tell a stranger that you are home alone. The kind of advice that the NRA is giving to women is the kind of advice that is often given to children. And it is very prescriptive, it is very directive. It bears no relevance. Like, even if you look at the FBI data, even if you look at like the location of crimes reported to law enforcement, there's no, cluster of crime in laundromats. Most violence in the home is not strangers, it's familiars. By contrast, there's a scholar whose name is M. Aziz, who wrote a dissertation about self-defense in the Black Liberation Movement in the United States over a 3 or 4 decade period. And they really documented how self-defense training was part of political organizing because organizers really did not trust that law enforcement or other institutions would keep them safe. When it comes to feminist or empowerment self-defense, the belief system is we live in a society that should be keeping everyone safe and is not succeeding at doing that. So, because of this injustice that impacts our safety, we are in a situation where people we know, like, love, depend on for our economic survival, depend on for our education, and on and on and on, may try to harm us when no one else is around. And because of that reality, we need practical skills that give us agency in the face of that reality. Some of the specifics that I've included in my book and that are kind of emblematic of empowerment self-defense are things like communicate your boundaries and pay attention to what the other person does. Even if it's something seemingly innocuous, like if you're a teenager and you're dating a new person and you say, I hate action movies, and without telling you, they put on an action movie, or they try and talk you out of that, or they make fun of you because you don't like action movies, that's a way of paying attention to what that person does when you tell them what you don't like. Another skill that we focus on is describing the behavior that alarms you. Sometimes a self-defense strategy can be as simple as breaking through the secrecy that this other person depends on to harm us. So if I say something like, I just moved away from you and now you move closer to me, or I said I didn't want to kiss you and you're trying to kiss me again. If I'm on the subway and I move away from someone and they start chatting with me and I say, I don't feel like talking. Any person that has any capacity to respect your boundaries is going to do anything else except keep talking to you. So, in that type of situation, I would say, okay, I said I didn't feel like talking and you're still talking to me. Can you please leave me alone? So, just very clear. It's almost like being the closed captioning under a television program, just literally stating what is happening. And then using a loud voice and keeping it simple. Because, like, I don't owe somebody a Shakespearean monologue when they're trying to harm me. So even if I repeat, stop, leave me alone, don't come any closer, And they're, calling me any number of names and telling me I'm overreacting and telling me that they're just trying to be friendly. Stop, leave me alone. Don't come any closer to me. One of the strengths of empowerment self-defense is that it is relevant to the majority of violence that is experienced by the people in the room. So when we teach people with disabilities, that is a different focus than when we teach local organizers in conservative communities that are facing harassment when they speak up at local events. That is different than we teach teenage girls. That is different than we teach women in corporate groups. That's different than we teach folks that live in shelters who are unhoused. So it's really just taking the lived experience and the reality that the folks in the room are facing, and presenting a range of skills that people can use to advocate for themselves in the face of threats or intimidation or imminent harm.
Well, Meg, thank you so much for taking the time. Before we go, I do want to go back up to that 30,000 foot view. You say most safety advice doesn't address gender-based violence. What should we be doing then to help combat this and promote gender equality on a broader scale? We're at a moment now where women's rights, at least abortion rights, are being rolled back. And sometimes it's scary just to even go online and see the ways in which men talk about women. So what's your take on what we should be doing as a society and how we actually push it forward here?
I think a lot of the struggle with preventing gender-based violence is that it's so easy to be against it and speak up and do something symbolic and token and meaningless. So there's no magical law that's going to stop people from harming other people in private when nobody can see them. There is real hope in parenting and sort of shifting expectations about consent and boundaries from a young age. But the reality is that brief educational programs for men and boys when they get to college or even in high school do not have a lot of evidence that they reduce perpetration. Whereas a lot of the strategies that really give women more economic power, political power, physical power have led to reductions in gender-based violence. So I think what organizations and institutions can do is really very actively and very proactively welcome resistance, boundaries, bodily autonomy. And when someone speaks up about a problem, take it seriously and be accountable instead of grabbing your lawyer and your PR consultant and trying to say as little as possible. So I think there are a million strategies that people are looking into, and there's some incredibly interesting research funded by the Centers for Disease Control before the current administration, who knows what's going on now, about everything from healthcare policy to earned income tax credits to, various ways that people can have more choice, more agency, and more power in their lives. But again, that is a really important question. And I was very committed in my book to not just writing about what's wrong, but the evidence of what's wrong could outweigh the evidence of what's working by sadly too much.
Meg Stone is the executive director of Impact Boston, a nonprofit that teaches empowerment or feminist self-defense. Her new book on the subject is The Cost of Fear: Why Most Safety Advice is Sexist and How We Can Stop Gender-Based Violence. It's out now through Beacon Press. And again, if you or someone you love has been impacted by domestic violence or sexual assault, help is available. The National Domestic Violence Hotline is available 24/7 at 1-800-799-SAFE or by texting START to 88788. RAIN's National Sexual Assault Hotline can be reached at 1-800-656-HOPE. Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio based in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcast.org or wherever you get your podcasts. You can stay in the loop on all of WAMC shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half. He was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. The night air down the hallway. I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool.